This episode of The Trail Went Cold is sponsored by This Is Actually Happening, a weekly podcast from Wondery that features extraordinary true stories of moments that changed absolutely everything for ordinary people. Listen to the latest episode of This Is Actually Happening on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Thank you, and enjoy the episode. July 26th, 1993. Lunhari, Wales. 65-year-old Harry Tews and his 67-year-old wife Megan Tews are both shot to death at the remote farm before their bodies are hidden inside the cowshed. The investigation eventually focuses on Jonathan Jones, the boyfriend of the Tews' daughter, and after his thumbprint is found on a saucer inside the residence, he is charged with the murders. Even though Jonathan is found guilty of the crime and sentenced to life imprisonment, his conviction is overturned 1 year later, and there are no conclusive answers about who actually killed Harry and Megan. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and for the first time, The Trail Went Cold is going to be exploring an unsolved cold case which took place in Wales, the 1993 murders of Harry and Megan Tews. And before you make the obvious jokes, yes, this is a couple from the United Kingdom named Harry and Megan, but they're considerably older than that other Harry and Megan who are always in the news because of their affiliation with the royal family. Harry and Megan Tews were an elderly married couple who lived on a remote farm and didn't seem to have any known enemies until they were both shot to death on their property, execution style. The Tews had a daughter named Cheryl, and investigators began to suspect her boyfriend Jonathan Jones committed the crime so that he could collect on a £150,000 estate Cheryl inherited from her parents. While Jonathan was eventually charged and convicted of the murders, the evidence against him was so weak that his conviction was overturned just 1 year after his trial. But of course that begs the question, if Jonathan did not kill the Tews, then who did? And what could their motive have possibly been? All attempts to link this crime to an alternate suspect have reached a dead end, and since this continues to rank as one of the most baffling crimes in the history of Wales, I thought it was worthy of exploration on this podcast. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved murders of Harry and Megan Tews. Our story begins in 1993 in Lunhari, a small village with a population of around 3,000, located in the county borough of Rhondda Cynon Taf in South Wales. Our central figures are 65-year-old Henry James Tews, who goes by the name Harry, and his 67-year-old wife, Megan Tews. The couple lives on an isolated 6-acre, 16th-century farm just a mile outside of Lunhari. The farm is named Tiari Wan, which is Welsh for house in the meadow, and the Tews have lived on the property for over 30 years. After having worked as a farmer and fruit wholesaler, Harry is now retired, and he and Megan have one child, a 33-year-old daughter named Cheryl, who works as a market researcher and lives nearly 200 miles away in Orpington, a town located in the county of Kent in southeastern Greater London. Cheryl shares a flat with her 33-year-old boyfriend, Jonathan Jones, and the couple have been together for over a decade after having originally met while graduate students at the Polytechnic of Wales. On the morning of Monday, July the 26th, Harry and Meghan drove to the post office in Lonhari to collect their pensions before they stopped at a supermarket to do some shopping, and a neighbor would see them returning home at around 11 a.m. At 1:30 p.m., another neighbor heard the sound of two gunshots from the Tuzas' farm, which occurred within 30 seconds of each other, but they did not find this unusual, because Harry liked to grow cabbage, and was known for shooting at rabbits who showed up in his patch. But over the course of the next several hours, both Cheryl and another relative made multiple attempts to call the Tuz residence, but were unable to reach Harry or Meghan on the phone. Cheryl spoke to her parents on the phone virtually every day, and became concerned when she received no answer during the time period when she knew they would usually be at home watching their favorite soap opera, Coronation Street. Cheryl finally decided to call a neighbor named Owen Hopkins and asked him to check on her parents. When Hopkins arrived at the farmhouse, he discovered that the front door was unlocked, but the Tuzes were not inside. The groceries they purchased on their shopping trip had been unpacked in the kitchen, and there was a pan on the cooker containing chopped potatoes, which suggested they were in the midst of preparing a meal before they disappeared. Hopkins decided to call the South Wales police to report the couple missing, and they soon arrived at the farm and launched a search effort. Well, during the early morning hours of July the 27th, Harry's body was discovered inside a cowshed on the property, and shortly thereafter, Meghan's body was found in there as well. Both victims have been shot in the back of the head, execution style, with a 12-bore shotgun, and their bodies were each covered with a carpet and concealed underneath some hay bales. The evidence seemed to suggest that Harry had been shot at close range just inside the cowshed's front door, while Meghan was shot outside from 3 feet away before her body was dragged in there. There were no signs of forced entry at the farmhouse, and nothing appeared to have been stolen, leaving investigators completely baffled about the motive. A fancy china teacup and saucer were resting on the dining room table next to a milk jug, a teapot, a sugar bowl, and a magazine. According to everyone who knew them, the Tuzas only brought out this teacup whenever they had visitors, so this seemed to indicate that the couple invited their killer inside the house and attempted to serve them tea before they were ambushed and shot to death. Unidentified palm prints were found on the farmyard gate and farmhouse door, but they did not belong to Harry, Meghan, or any members of their family, and could not be matched to anyone. Unfortunately, the crime scene was not properly sealed until several hours after the police's arrival, and evidence was not preserved, as they initially operated under the mistaken assumption that the crime was a murder-suicide until it became apparent that no gun could be found. Before the bodies were discovered, some police officers had noticed a small pool of blood by the farmyard gate, but it was trampled over so many times that it became contaminated and deemed to be useless as evidence. Interestingly enough, about 10 months before the murders, Harry had reported a burglary at the farmhouse where his shotgun was stolen. It was never recovered, and Harry wound up purchasing a new shotgun, but it was unclear if this theft had any connection to the crime. After her parents were reported missing, Cheryl wanted to make the nearly 200-mile drive to the farmhouse in order to check what was going on. However, because she had to work the following morning, she asked her boyfriend Jonathan Jones to drive there instead. Jonathan left at approximately 10 p.m. on the evening of the 26th, and arrived at around 3 a.m. on the morning of the 27th, by which point he was informed by police that a male body had been found inside the cowshed. Investigators believe that Jonathan aroused suspicion by barely reacting to this news, as he did not even ask if the body belonged to Harry, though Jonathan would later attribute this to being exhausted following the long drive. They also found it odd that it took Jonathan 5 hours to make a drive, which ordinarily would have taken 3.5 hours, but he had made 2 separate stops at service stations in order to fuel up his car and phone Cheryl. And since the weather was rainy, Jonathan said he was forced to drive slower than usual to navigate the dark, rural roads. Regardless, the South Wales police started to focus on Jonathan as a potential suspect. Well, months after the murders took place, it was discovered that Jonathan's thumbprint was on the saucer beneath the teacup found on the Tuzes' dining room table. Investigators started formulating a theory that on the day of the crime, Jonathan made the trip from Orpington to Lonhari to visit the farm, and was invited inside the house by Harry and Megan. They may have been expecting Jonathan to ask for permission to marry their daughter, so to celebrate the occasion, the Tuzes brought out the special china to serve Jonathan some tea, but it wasn't long before he shot them to death and concealed their bodies in the cowshed. At the time, Cheryl was hoping to open her own market research firm, but she and Jonathan were often in arrears with the rent, and he had less than £100 in his bank account. But since Cheryl stood to be the beneficiary of her parents' £150,000 estate, investigators suspected that Jonathan killed them so that she could inherit the money. Even though there was no other physical evidence linking Jonathan to the crime, and the murder weapon could not be found, the South Wales police arrested Jonathan and charged him with the murders in December of 1993. While Cheryl immediately disputed the idea that Jonathan killed Harry and Megan for the inheritance, as she had around £7,000 in her savings account at the time, and they still could have borrowed money from her parents or Jonathan's parents if they really needed to. In spite of this, Jonathan's trial would begin in Newport Crown Court in April of 1995 and last for 12 weeks. The only physical evidence which placed Jonathan at the murder scene was the thumbprint on the saucer, but since Jonathan was a frequent visitor to the farmhouse, the defense argued that he could have left the thumbprint there on a previous occasion. After Jonathan arrived at the farm and was informed that Harry's body had been found, the police allowed him to sit in the dining room alone for an extended period of time while the teacup and saucer were still on the table. It was possible that Jonathan could have touched the saucer during this time period and left his thumbprint there, though he was unable to recall this with 100% certainty. The prosecution believed that Jonathan was responsible for the burglary in which Harry's shotgun was stolen, and he proceeded to hold on to it for nearly a year before he used the shotgun as the murder weapon and disposed of it. However, the calculated nature of the murders suggested that whoever shot the Tuzes was an experienced gunman who was very skilled with handling firearms, but according to Jonathan's family, the only time he ever handled a gun in his life was when he attended a naval base during his teen years. The prosecution alleged that Jonathan either drove to the Tuz farm to commit the murders or traveled to the area by train before getting off at nearby Pontyclean railway station, but no paper trail could be found to confirm this. And even though Jonathan was a very distinct-looking individual at 6 feet 5 inches tall, no eyewitnesses recalled seeing him in the area that day. While Jonathan maintained that he was in Orpington the entire day, the prosecution attempted to poke holes in his alibi and believed that he would have had enough time to make the nearly 400-mile round trip to Lonhari and back. Jonathan claimed that he spent the morning looking for rental offices, which could potentially be used to set up the market research firm Cheryl was hoping to start. Investigators were unable to find any real estate agents who could confirm this, but Jonathan maintained that he never spoke to any agents that day, because he had already consulted with some of them in the past. Jonathan claimed that he returned to his flat at around noon and cleaned it up a little bit before he went out for a solitary walk. He then returned to the flat a second time at approximately 1:30 p.m. and encountered three lift engineers who were performing some repair work in the building's basement. Jonathan claimed that he briefly spoke to these lift engineers, but when they were called upon to testify, none of them could recall this conversation. Afterward, Jonathan said he watched a game of cricket on television until around 3 o'clock, before he left the flat again to run some errands. Cheryl had spent the day at work and could not confirm Jonathan's whereabouts, but she said that when she returned to the flat during the early evening hours, it looked like it had recently been tidied up, like Jonathan said. Well, the case would go to the jury, but unlike North America, a verdict does not necessarily have to be unanimous in the United Kingdom. If a unanimous verdict is not possible, a majority of 10 to 2 is accepted, and that's exactly what happened here. After 2 days of deliberation, the jury found Jonathan guilty of the murders by a 10 to 2 majority, and he would receive 2 life sentences. In spite of this, Cheryl never believed that her boyfriend was responsible for killing her parents. Even though Jonathan had phoned Cheryl from prison and advised her to get on with her life, she refused to do so and continued to stand by him. She insisted that Jonathan was a kind man who had a great relationship with her parents, and he pretty much considered Harry to be like a second father to him. Cheryl would spend the next year campaigning for Jonathan's release, even going so far as to offer a £25,000 reward for information, leading to the apprehension of the real killer. Cheryl's actions alienated many members of her extended family, particularly her paternal uncle and aunt, David and Cynthia Tews, who believed that Jonathan was guilty, and started to accuse Cheryl of being complicit in the killings. While the case for Jonathan's innocence would get a major boost only 4 days after the conclusion of his trial, when the presiding judge, Justice Richard Rougier, wrote separate letters to the Home Secretary and Jonathan's defense counsel. Even though Justice Rougier had sentenced Jonathan to the mandatory term of life imprisonment, he admitted that he had, quote-unquote, significant doubt about the conviction, and stated, quote, "I am bound to record that the verdict caused me some surprise," end quote. Rougier even gave defense counsel permission to use his comments as part of Jonathan's legal appeal. Over the course of the next year, Jonathan's attorneys were able to obtain evidence which showed that lift engineers had performed repair work in Jonathan's building on the afternoon of July the 26, 1993. So even though the lift engineers did not recall speaking with him, this seemed to support Jonathan's story that he was entering his flat at 1:30 p.m., the same approximate time period when the Tews' neighbor reported hearing gunshots at their farm. Jonathan's case would be heard in front of 3 justices from the Court of Appeal, and on April the 25th, 1996, they all ruled that his conviction was unsafe. Jonathan's conviction was subsequently quashed, and he was released from prison. Since they still believed that Jonathan was the killer, the South Wales police initially stated that they had no plans to reopen the investigation, which outraged Jonathan and Cheryl. But within the next 4 years, they finally appointed a panel to take a fresh look at the case. In 2003, the barrels of a 12-bore shotgun were discovered in a disused quarry located near the Tews' farm, and 2 shotgun cartridges and a hold-all bag were found inside a flooded iron ore mine shaft. There was speculation that these items might have been used in the murders, but it was not conclusively proven. During the same time period, the South Wales police received an anonymous letter about the case, which they said was of interest to them, though they have never publicly revealed the letter's contents. They also said they were launching a search for a black 4x4 and a red saloon car, 2 vehicles which had reportedly been seen in the Lonhari area around the time of the murders, but neither of them was located. In 2008, on the day before the 15th anniversary of the crime, the South Wales police announced that their investigation had reached a dead end, so the inquiry team of officers they had assembled to explore the case would be scaled down. This news came as a great disappointment to Cheryl and Jonathan, who had since gotten married and continue to remain together to this day. But Jonathan has never received any compensation for his wrongful incarceration. All attempts to uncover a strong alternate suspect of the crime have been unsuccessful, so after 28 years, the murders of Harry and Megan Tews have never been conclusively solved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to talk about another terrific podcast. This is actually happening as a weekly podcast from Wondery that features extraordinary true stories of moments that changed absolutely everything for ordinary people. As examples, you'll hear from a woman who heads out for a quick bike ride in the Swiss Alps and finds herself lost in a dark, icy unknown. Or a woman who went to Maui in search of a healer, but instead went missing for 17 days in a rainforest. We've all had powerful moments in our lives that have given us the feeling of nothing is ever going to be the same, and This Is Actually Happening explores these moments head-on. These riveting stories are told in the first person, so you can experience them through their eyes, and they're definitely unforgettable, perspective-changing stories. The titles for each episode function as an intriguing hook for the featured story, with such titles as What If Wrong Turn Meant Life or Death, or What If You Went Missing, and you often cannot anticipate where they will go. These stories range from the tragic to the inspiring, but as someone who has just started listening to this podcast and is binging through the episodes, I can tell you that these stories are always very enthralling to listen to, and you will probably learn a lot about the human condition. As someone who's listened to podcasts for a very long time and thought they heard it all, I can tell you that some of the revelations you'll hear in This Is Actually Happening are pretty eye-opening. So listen to the latest episode of This Is Actually Happening on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So I've covered a number of cases on this podcast which never reached a definitive conclusion because the authorities initially arrested or convicted the wrong person. In some of those cases, you get the impression that investigators developed serious tunnel vision and ignored obvious leads to focus on the wrong individual, but in the case of Harry and Megan Tooze, there was very little to work with at all. I definitely believe that on the basis of the evidence against him, Jonathan Jones never should have gone on trial for these murders, let alone been convicted, but at the same time, I can understand why the South Wales police would have zeroed in on him as a potential suspect, since nothing about this crime makes any sense. It sounds like investigators were at such a dead end that when they discovered Jonathan's thumbprint on the saucer, they decided to focus all their energies on him, even though there was really no other evidence to implicate Jonathan or place him at the murder scene. I guess on the surface, the idea of him murdering his in-laws to cash in on his girlfriend's £150,000 inheritance might not seem like an implausible motive, especially when you consider that there doesn't seem to be a discernible motive for anyone else to have committed this crime. This seemed like the work of some cold, calculated assassin, as both Harry and Megan were shot in the back of the head, execution style, but who would want to target this seemingly harmless elderly couple? While Jonathan had his conviction quashed and he was released from prison, I guess he wasn't technically exonerated per se and declared to be factually innocent. It's not like there was some slam-dunk DNA evidence to clear him, but even so, it's extremely unlikely that he could have committed this crime. I hate to say this, but Jonathan actually lucked out better than most wrongly imprisoned individuals, since he got released only about a year after he was originally convicted. However, this was an extremely traumatic ordeal for Jonathan and his loved ones, and I don't think they've ever really recovered. By the time Jonathan was arrested, Cheryl had become pregnant, but the whole situation caused severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and she began to suffer from a rare condition during her pregnancy, which caused the cartilage between the bones in her body to waste away. After Cheryl's son was born, the cartilage started to recover, but not throughout her entire body. As a result, Cheryl partially lost her hearing, and to this day, it is very difficult for her to walk without support. By all accounts, Cheryl was usually a shy, quiet woman, but Jonathan's wrongful incarceration turned her into a fighter, and her loyalty to him helped ensure his release. She did this even though it alienated her from the rest of her extended family, who were very outspoken about their belief that Cheryl was helping get a killer out of prison. However, Cheryl maintained that she and Jonathan both had a very close relationship with her parents, whereas these other family members barely saw Harry and Megan while they were alive, and only started coming out of the woodwork when their murders received national headlines. Of course, the ordeal pretty much caused Cheryl and Jonathan to lose all faith in the justice system, and during a 2008 interview with Wales Online, Jonathan stated, quote, "We may be walking down the street and I am eating a Mars bar, for example, and I will put a wrapper in the bin, and Cheryl will pull it out in case a crime is committed nearby, and the police would come along and find my DNA. That's the sort of paranoia that's still with both of us to some extent." End quote. The fact that Jonathan and Cheryl were so close to the Tooze's and often visited their farm makes it seem plausible that Jonathan's thumbprint could have wound up on that saucer on a previous occasion prior to the murders. Or alternatively, Jonathan could have touched the saucer when he traveled to the farmhouse after the murders and not even realized it. Without the thumbprint, the other alleged evidence against Jonathan was weak sauce, such as him supposedly not reacting much when he learned that Harry's body had been found. It seemed like the prosecution's case was based around discrediting Jonathan's alibi that he was in Orpington on the day of the crime. But the problem is that they didn't actually offer much evidence which proved that Jonathan could have been in Lanhari committing the crime during that time period. Remember, traveling from Orpington to Lanhari and back is a nearly 400-mile round trip, and it would be pretty difficult to do that without being seen by any eyewitnesses or leaving a paper trail or physical evidence behind. It's one thing if no witnesses recalled seeing Jonathan in Orpington, a section of Greater London which has a population of around 90,000, but in a small village like Lanhari, I think a distinctive 6'5" individual like Jonathan would have stood out a lot more, yet no one reported seeing him there that day. That's the tricky thing about alibis. A guilty person who commits a crime might go the extra mile to fabricate an alibi for himself, whereas a completely innocent person is likely just going to be living out a routine, ordinary day and not thinking too much about their actions. If Jonathan's account is accurate, then his day was completely unremarkable, as he spent most of his time alone doing such mundane tasks as looking at rental offices, walking around, and watching television in his flat. Jonathan described briefly speaking to some lift engineers in his building around the approximate time period his in-laws were likely murdered, and if they had corroborated this story, this would have proven that Jonathan couldn't have committed the crime. When these lift engineers were called upon to testify, they did not recall speaking with Jonathan that day, but keep in mind that this was years after the fact, so it's not surprising that they may not have been able to recall such a mundane event from a seemingly ordinary day. I know that Justice Rougier helped pave the way for the quashing of Jonathan's conviction when he sent off letters openly expressing his surprise at the guilty verdict. But ironically enough, Rougier may have inadvertently paved the way for this verdict when he gave instructions to the jury before deliberations. Part of Jonathan's alibi was that he had been watching a cricket match on TV at his flat on the afternoon of the crime, and during his testimony, Jonathan provided specific details about the match, including how the commentators had mentioned stoppages for rain. Well, during his instructions, Justice Rougier told the jury that there had been no rain stoppages during that particular match, which was a bit misleading. Jonathan never said he witnessed any stoppages for rain, only that the commentators had talked about the subject. Rougier received criticism for potentially misdirecting the jury, so I think his letters expressing doubt about the verdict were his attempt to make things right. I know that Rougier stated that if Jonathan was guilty of this crime, he was exceptionally cunning, because you'd think that a guy with no criminal record, who had supposedly not handled a gun in 2 decades, would leave a lot more damning evidence behind if he took such a lengthy trip in order to commit a double murder. Following Jonathan's release from prison, it seemed to take a while for the South Wales police to finally acknowledge that there might be another killer out there somewhere, but they did ultimately launch a new investigation. Given that a neighbor reported hearing 2 shots from the Two's property at around 1:30 p.m., and Harry and Megan reached shot only once, it's reasonable to assume that this is when the murders took place. And since no one else showed up at the farm to check on the couple until several hours later, the killer would have had ample time to cover up the crime and dispose of evidence. Once you discount the idea that the Tuzers were murdered so that their daughter could inherit the estate, there doesn't seem to be any apparent motive for this crime, as Harry and Megan didn't have any known enemies, and nothing appeared to have been stolen from the residence. I started to wonder if the whole thing might have just been some sort of thrill kill from someone who wanted to murder a random couple and selected the Tuzes because they happened to live on an isolated farm. However, since the aforementioned teacup and saucer were found on the dining room table and the couple appeared to be in the midst of preparing lunch, it does seem like the killer was invited into their home and they might have been familiar with them. Everyone who knew the Tuzes said that they never brought out that particular china unless they had a guest. The circumstances of how Harry and Megan were shot and how their bodies wound up in the cowshed are not entirely clear. It seems like Harry was shot just inside the cowshed's front door, and Megan was shot outside before her body was dragged in there and they were both concealed. It's possible that Megan was inside the cowshed when her husband was shot and attempted to make a run for it, or she heard the shot from inside the farmhouse and came running outside before she was ambushed. For all we know, the killer may have led Harry and Megan to the cowshed at gunpoint, or Harry escorted the perpetrator in there and was taken by complete surprise when he was shot. We have unidentified palm prints on the farmyard gate and the farmhouse's front door, which did not match the Tuzes, Cheryl, or Jonathan. They might belong to the killer, but because the police did not do a good job preserving the crime scene, it sounds like there isn't much in the way of physical evidence at all. So who do we have in terms of alternate suspects? Well, in the weeks prior to the murders, 2 eyewitnesses claimed that they drove past a man in a trench coat and dark sunglasses walking down the road in the direction of the Tuzes farm. He was carrying a hold-all bag, and when he noticed the car passing by, the man apparently made an attempt to conceal his face, and the witnesses were pretty certain he was not Jonathan Jones, as he was described as being considerably shorter than Jonathan at around 5'9". We've had police provide descriptions of vehicles which were supposedly seen in the area on the day of the crime and have never been located, and there have also been vague reports from neighbors that they heard loud arguing from the two's property during this time period. But I think the most intriguingly was provided by a solicitor who claimed that Harry visited his office a week before the murder took place and was accompanied by a middle-aged man whom he described as a quote-unquote plummy-voiced stranger. In case you're not familiar with that term, the definition of plummy is that it is used to describe a low voice or way of speaking using long vowels of a type thought to be typical of the English upper social class. The solicitor said that Harry inquired about his mother-in-law's will, as Meghan's mother had left them the farm when she passed away years earlier. This meeting was described as being quote-unquote tense, and while details are pretty vague, the plummy-voiced stranger has never come forward or been identified. But interestingly enough, prior to this meeting, Harry had made a phone call to the National Farmers Union where he claimed that someone was trying to evict him, but he never offered any additional information. So if Harry feared that he was going to be evicted, that might explain why he felt compelled to check his mother-in-law's will to make sure that the property was his. The situation seems pretty odd, since the Tooses had lived at the farm for over 3 decades at that point, so who was trying to evict them? Was it the same man who accompanied Harry to the solicitor's office? If not, then who was this guy? I suppose that if someone wanted the Tooses' land, this could have given them a potential motive to commit murder, but since Cheryl wound up inheriting their estate, I'm not sure if anyone else gained anything from this crime. I suppose this alleged eviction could have been some elaborate con job from the killer, but what exactly was their endgame? And if the plummy-voiced stranger was planning to kill the Tooses, why would he allow himself to be seen by the solicitor? The fact that this man has never come forward seems to suggest that he was involved in this crime, but I just have this feeling that there's a big piece of the puzzle missing somewhere which might shed some light on what happened. I know police received an anonymous letter pertaining to the case in the early 2000s, and while they've never publicly revealed its contents, I wonder if it provides any additional insight on the situation. Now, over the past decade, investigators have looked at a convicted serial killer named John Cooper, a career criminal with a long history of burglaries and sexual assaults, who is currently incarcerated for a pair of double murders. In 1985, Cooper was working as a farm laborer in the county of Pembrokeshire, and on December the 22nd, he decided to break into a mansion located near the village of Scoveston to perform a burglary. The mansion was owned by 58-year-old Richard Thomas and his 54-year-old sister Helen Thomas, whom Cooper had previously worked for, and it sounds like he was expecting the residence to be unoccupied. However, Helen happened to be there, and Cooper killed her with a shotgun blast to the face when she recognized his voice. Before Cooper had a chance to leave, Richard returned home and was killed with a shotgun blast to the face as well. Cooper subsequently set fire to the house in an attempt to destroy evidence before fleeing the scene. On June the 29th, 1989, Cooper committed another double murder in Pembrokeshire, and this time, the two victims were 51-year-old Peter Dixon and his 52-year-old wife Gwenda Dixon, a couple who had traveled to the area on a camping trip. The Dixons were taking a walk down the Pembrokeshire coastal path when they crossed paths with Cooper, who was carrying a sawed-off shotgun, and he proceeded to rob and tie up the couple before sexually assaulting them. Cooper then forced the Dixons to hand over their bank card and provide their personal identification number before he fatally shot them and later drained money from their accounts. In a bizarre turn of events, Cooper had recently been a contestant on the popular British game show Bullseye, and the episode aired only 1 month before the crime took place. In fact, footage from the show would eventually be used to match Cooper to a composite sketch which had been created from eyewitness descriptions. 2 decades later, Cooper was finally linked to both of these crimes via DNA evidence, and after being convicted in May of 2011, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Attempts have been made to link Cooper to a number of cold cases, including the murders of Harry and Meghan Tooze, and given the circumstances, I can understand why, as double shotgun murders in the United Kingdom are extremely rare. Like I mentioned earlier, it seemed like whoever killed Harry and Meghan was very skilled at using a shotgun, and we know that Cooper previously murdered at least 2 couples in that fashion. As you might recall, the barrels of a 12-bore shotgun, 2 shotgun cartridges, and a hold-all bag were all discovered in a quarry and mine shaft located in close proximity to the Tooze farm. While it's never been conclusively proven that these items were used in the murders, it's worth noting that the shotgun barrels were painted white, which is something that Cooper liked to do with his own shotgun. But while there are some similarities between the Two's murders and Cooper's other crimes, there are also a number of differences. Cooper's victims received shotgun blasts to the face, whereas the Two's were shot in the back of the head. The Thomases and the Dixons were murdered in Pembrokeshire, which is where Cooper pretty much lived his entire life, but it's around 100 miles away from Lonhari, and there's nothing to indicate that Cooper had any familiarity with the area at all, other than the fact that he attended an appointment at a hospital in the nearby town of Bridgend 1 year before the Two's murders. But the key difference which makes me lean away from Cooper being the perpetrator in this case is motive. Throughout the course of his life, Cooper was known to have committed at least 30 burglaries, but nothing was stolen from the Two's farmhouse, which seems very out of character for him. Remember, the main reason Cooper murdered the Thomases was because he had decided to burglarize their mansion and was not expecting them to be there. And it sounds like Cooper picked out the Dixons at random when he came across the couple on the coastal path and decided to rob them. It definitely does not seem like robbery was the primary motive for the Two's murders, so why would Cooper have targeted them? It just seems like there was something a lot more personal about this crime. Now, Cooper wound up being linked to the Thomas and Dixon murders via DNA testing, but considering how contaminated the crime scene was at the Two's farmhouse, I'm not sure if any DNA evidence even exists in this case. At the time of this recording, Cooper is a month away from turning 77 years old, and he's definitely going to remain locked up for the rest of his life, but I'm not sure how much time he has left for the authorities to link him to the Two's case or any other unsolved crimes. But I am inclined to believe that Cooper was not responsible for these murders, as it just seems like there was something more at stake here than simple robbery. So overall, this is definitely a very baffling crime, and given the sloppy nature of the original investigation, and the police placing so much emphasis on Jonathan Jones, it may be hard to figure out what really happened here. I tend to think that the killer might be the unidentified man seen alongside Harry in the solicitor's office, and even though the Two's were always in constant communication with their daughter, I have a feeling that something may have been going on in their lives during this time period, which they never told Cheryl about. It's possible that someone out there had a personal beef with the Two's, but this whole crime might have just been some sort of thrill kill by a psychopath who wanted to murder an elderly couple. The whole thing seems so calculated that I would not be surprised if the perpetrator is killed before or since then. Otherwise, this is a major head-scratcher, and unfortunately, it pretty much destroyed the lives of Cheryl Two's and Jonathan Jones, so both they and Harry and Megan deserve justice. So if you happen to have any information about the murders of Harry and Megan Two's, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about a famous case which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 attack on Jenny Pratt, who was hit in the back of the head with a 2x4 by the occupants of a speeding truck, a crime which left her with considerable brain damage, but the perpetrators were never caught. I'm also going to start dropping the occasional exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we just released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the Aileen Conway case from Unsolved Mysteries, which was also the subject of my debut episode of The Trail Went Cold. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Josie S., John G., Douglas, LT, Kevin C., Mary Ellen K., and Brian B. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, I just wanted to announce that The Trail Went Cold is very close to reaching a special milestone of 500 Patreon subscribers, and if we happen to reach that goal by the end of August, we will release a special Patreon-exclusive bonus episode for you folks sometime in September, which will be available to all of our patrons in Tiers 1, 2, and 3. So if you haven't signed up with us, we strongly encourage you to join and help us reach our goal of 500 patrons. And in just under 2 months, provided that it's safe enough to travel there, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.